mechanically, that will electronically lengthen your piece of wire and make it electronically resonant to your frequency. Whether or not it's resonant, the right kind of testing will tell you by sweeping the frequency, measuring the Viswell, plotting the curve. If it's resonant at your frequency, you get a dip in the Viswell curve at your favorite frequency for that length of wire, with that method of feeding it, with that method of making it electronically tuned with the loading coil, top hat capacitor, or whatever. To add a top hat capacitor at the end of the wire is very simple to do. But boy, that'll lower the frequency real fast. You can make a 40-foot length piece of wire resonant at 40 meters by doing that. So it's just something you have to get used to, and these are the tuning techniques that many amateurs are not yet familiar with, and I wish they were. W2 Bravo Zulu, keep asking questions, Rich. K2RIW in the TechNet.
TechNet W2BC. Okay, now remember, this screwdriver, I worked the world with this screwdriver on the car with a 46-inch whip screwed into the top of it. I worked the world in days, you know, in days of better propagation. So with the car under it, you know, as the counterpoise, so that's all it needed was 46 inches. And I think what you're saying is if I can lower this coil on the screwdriver antenna, I could very well make a 40-foot piece of wire resonant on a bunch of frequencies. Is that true?
Yeah, back up a little bit here now, Rich. It's clear in your head, but you didn't tell us. When you were working the world with the 46-inch whip on the screwdriver antenna on your automobile, was that on 20 meters? What frequency were you using when you worked the world? Over to you, Rich.
10 through 80. I mean, I don't know if I worked the world on 80, but 40 and 20. And, of course, the antenna gets more efficient. This type of antenna gets more efficient, you know, the higher in frequency you go. So, of course, 10, 15, 17, 20, this antenna, you know, my radio likes the best with this antenna, you know, so dicey in terms of raising it, you know, this coil could only be raised to a certain level, then there was no more coil left in the antenna, but the antenna is designed for 10 through 80.
Okay, I've seen pictures, I've seen some of the diagrams on the screwdriver antenna. I wasn't familiar with the fact that that tuning coil mechanism, the screwdriver mechanism at the bottom, I didn't realize it had such an extremely large tuning range. A 46-inch piece of wire would give you a reasonable standing wave ratio, is what you seem to be saying, on 10 through 80 meters. To have it on 10, 15, 20, and maybe 40, I can sort of see that. If the coil had enough turns to it and enough tuning ratio that it would even give you a less than 3-to-1 standing wave ratio on 80 meters, then I am learning something. I am learning that screwdriver mechanism has got a lot more tuning range than I knew about. You're giving me a new education on this one, Rich. That's 2 Bravo Zulu, K2LIW.
But that was only, it would only work using the internal antenna tuner of the Kenwood 440. I could not get it down to any reasonable FWO without that antenna tuner.
Okay, now it's starting to make a lot more sense. My guess is you had a strong need for that antenna tuner on anything except, 20 meters. Maybe one of those bands, the antenna tuner didn't have to work very hard. Sounds to me like on many of those bands, the antenna tuner had to do a yeoman job of re-resonating. Okay, when you re-resonate with an antenna tuner, that is another way of taking a length of wire that's the wrong length and forcing it to be electronically resonant at your favorite frequency. An antenna tuner does that. So where the tuning mechanism is located becomes a little bit mysterious until you look at the whole big picture. It could be a loading coil in the middle of the wire. It could be a very large tuning range of the screwdriver mechanism. It can be a very large tuning range of an antenna tuner feeding the screwdriver antenna. So lots of places where you can force resonance. But until that antenna is resonant at your favorite frequency, the whole radiating system resonant, everything from the transmitter, antenna tuner, screwdriver, and so on, until it is resonant at your favorite frequency, it's not going to work very well. And you, by way of that antenna tuner, which apparently had a good amount of range, and your screwdriver had a whole lot of range, you managed to do that with a 46-inch whip. Amazing. So you found a better solution than I would have predicted. Over to you, Rich, W2BZ, K2LAW.
It was fun for a while, and I'm just talking 100 watts barefoot with a Kenwood 440 SAT, which means internal antenna tuner. And so now, what I'm trying to use this screwdriver antenna with the loading coil. I guess that's the right term. Is the right term the loading coil, the one that's moving up and down with the motor and the screwdriver? Because that's, you know, that's what it does. And the way you use an antenna like this is you move it up and down on the band you want to operate and listen for the maximum background noise. Then you stop it there and you do the internal into the Kenwood, the internal antenna tuner, and you should be okay with that 46-inch whip, which I was. I can't say that I worked many people on 80, but I sure did on 40, from 10 to 40.
And calling the base of your screwdriver antenna a matching coil, a tuning coil, a screwdriver adjusting mechanism, all those words convey the concept. It looks to me like it has a nice, large tuning range combined with a good antenna tuner. That's quite a system. You've got more capability there than I knew about. And now you want to go from the sheet metal of the automobile being the counterpoise, the ground plane, the thing you were feeding against, to a stake in the ground at your property. That's an interesting transition. But I think with a little bit of fiddling around, you can make it work. And will it work with a 46-inch whip? I'm a little worried about that one. To make it a 67-foot piece of wire at a slanted angle, that may not be the whole solution either because of the cucumber intercepting the earth. Well, the 46-inch whip had a cucumber. The bottom section of it was touching the car and the earth a little bit. It's going to take some experimenting, but once you know what you're looking for, whatever is the radiating section, if you make it electronically resonant, let me drop this. Electronically resonant at your favorite frequency, which really means when you tune across the band and plot standing wave ratio, you get a bathtub-shaped curve, and the bottom of the curve is usually the point where it resonates. And you can make the wire longer, shorter, zigzag it, add loading coil, stretch the loading coil, shrink the loading coil, that you put in the middle of the wire, or readjust the loading and tuning coil on your screwdriver. There's various ways you can tune this thing, and adding doodads to it, adding gimmicks to it. A top hat capacitor could have been added to your 46-inch whip. Had you done that, you would have had a hell of a lot more performance at 80 meters. That screwdriver antenna with a 46-inch whip on your automobile. If you had this mechanism that when you're on 80 meters, you plug it into the end of the wire, the amount of work your antenna tuner would have had it done would be drastically decreased. You would have had a lot more performance on 80 meters if you had known to do that. And that gimmick capacitor to the top hat of the 46-inch piece of wire, had you known that, that would have been very easy to do and easy to store in the trunk of your car. W2BZ, K2LAW.
I got it now. If you would give me permission, I think I would start off with building a 9-to-1 matching transformer to go in between the ground stake and the base of the antenna and see what that does, and then I could play around. I think I have a run of about 50 feet of wire. So not quite a quarter wavelength on 40, but I think I'll start like that, and I'll go on the Berkeley site and take a look at what they suggest. for matching, and all I'm doing, I need a substitute for the car. That's basically what this comes down to. Everything else is going to stay the same. I just need, except, you know, I thought that I would be smart in extending that four to 66 or 50 feet. Because remember, these antennas aren't designed to have a 50-foot piece of wire trailing behind your car as you're moving down the road. So, I know where to start now, Dick, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Your 9-to-1 balance you're going to use to try to get from 50 ohms to the 2,000 ohms of an in-fed, half-wave, electronically resonant radiating system. The 9-to-1 balance is a step in the right direction. It steps up the impedance, but it doesn't necessarily do the simultaneous resonating. A properly chosen L network with the Berkeley program simultaneously steps up the impedance. An L network, you adjust the L-C ratio, the amount of C and the amount of L. If you choose the right ratio, you can step up the impedance from 2-to-1 to 200-to-1. I'm not kidding. You can get a huge ratio just by choosing the right inductor and capacitor of an L network. Simultaneously, it will give you resonance. In other words, if your antenna, the radiating section of the antenna is inductive, it'll supply the capacitance to resonate. Or if it's capacitive, it'll supply the inductance. So once you know the impedance of the end of your antenna, the reactive component and the resistive component, that's a little bit difficult. I'll admit that requires an antenna tuner, an antenna and an analyzer to find it. If you had that information and you fed it into the Berkeley program, the L network in one step would give you simultaneous resonance and simultaneous impedance step up of any ratio you desire. Let me drop. Any ratio that you desire. However, the 9-to-1 balance gives you the right impedance ratio. It doesn't necessarily establish simultaneous re-resonating, if you know what I mean. Yes, I guess you can take your 9-to-1 and add a tuning capacitor to it in series or in parallel and supply some of this extra function. So I'll admit I'm supplying to you a method of approach that is not super simple. I'll admit that there's a lot of steps involved here. If you had an antenna analyzer and you could choose your radiating system, whether it's a 31-foot piece of wire, a 47-inch whip, or your 67-foot piece of wire at a crazy angle, if you had an antenna analyzer and you could measure its resistive and reactive impedance and plug it into Berkeley, in one step you'd have a solution. I don't think you've got the antenna analyzer. You've got a whole lot of cut-and-try capability. You've got a little bit of time on your hands. You're a guy with a lot of perspicacity, a lot of enthusiasm. You'll find a solution. There is a solution here. I'll admit I'm not making it super simple for you. You're simultaneously learning some theory. You're learning some methods of approach. And it's going to require some elbow grease. I'll admit I'm not making it as simple as I wish I could for you, Rich. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2LIW in the TechNet. But don't give up. You've got a solution there. You just have to find it.
You are making it simple, because what I'm hearing you say is start at the top of the antenna first. When I say the top, you know, in terms of your L network, the whip or a length of wire coming out of the top, start there, not at the bottom, not at the grounding point. Start there, see what you have. And I do have an antenna analyzer, by the way, which would come in tremendously handy to see this stuff right away. It's an AA, it's a Rig Experts AA30-0. And the reason why it's zero is because I just bought the circuit board. They're selling the circuit board of their AA30 analyzer for just $77, and it works. I wired it up, and it works. But I'm going to start with the L network at the top, whatever is going to be coming out of the top, and then match it at the bottom, correct?
I'm getting an unreasonable mental image. If your chosen length of wire happened to be 35 feet of wire, vertically polarized, and you're going to measure at the top. That sounds like you're standing 35 feet off the ground, so measure, starting at the top is confusing me. You're feeding the end of a half-wave resonating structure that radiates, and the bottom end of it that connects to the screwdriver, that bottom end is where you want to measure the impedance. So measuring at the top, I'm not quite sure what that means. Are you suspended in the air when you're doing that measurement? W2BZ, K2RIW?
Sorry, Dick, I meant the top of the screwdriver. In other words, the 46-inch whip screws into the top of the screwdriver antenna, this barrel, basically, with a coil that goes up and down. It screws into the top of that. That's what I meant by top. So if I had a 33 or 66-foot wire coming into that top instead of the 46-inch whip, it's there at the top of the screwdriver that I put the matching L network or whatever to bring, you know, to bring the resonance to where I want it.
Beautiful. That made it a lot clearer. When you kept saying the word top, and you didn't plug in top of screwdriver mechanism. And you said the top of the wire. You can see what I was getting the right picture. Okay. You've got a number of approaches here. It's going to require some experimentation. You're a lot better off than I expected. You've got an antenna analyzer. And you can choose whatever your radiating system is going to be. Your antenna analyzer requires two wires to be connected. One could be to the grounding system or the top of the screwdriver, with your choice. The other wire going to your antenna analyzer goes to your half-wave resonator, and you measure that impedance, the resistive component, the reactive component, and Berkeley will tell you what to do with it. But you may find out that your the great tuning range of your screwdriver mechanism might do a beautiful job without another L network. It might do a beautiful job of covering you on 20 and 15 meters, for instance. With some experimentation, you'll find that out. I'm slowly concluding, though, that your screwdriver mechanism has got a lot of tuning range. It can give you a lot of stealthy solutions here. Good luck with this project. It's not going to be falling off a log, but it's worth pursuing, and you're going to again eventually get what you want, Rich. W2PZ, K2LIW.
Great. I understand more than I'm letting on. I mean, from your going over and over and over, I get it now, actually. And like you said, it may require that L network at the top of the screwdriver antenna. You're right. I don't have an 85-foot ladder or whatever, 66-foot ladder. But there are four components here, the way I see it. It's the length of the wire coming out of the screwdriver, the coil of the screwdriver, the impedance matching at the bottom of the screwdriver, and the antenna tuner in the radio. Or, if necessary, some type of device, matching device, between the 66-foot wire and the top of the screwdriver antenna, right above the coil.
You're getting a better and better picture as this proceeds, Rich. And by the way, the tuning mechanism, if you add it, the L network, a loading coil or whatever, you've got at least two different choices as to where to put it, maybe three. Yes, it could be going into the screwdriver mechanism, between the screwdriver and the rig with the antenna tuner. It could be coming out of the top of the screwdriver mechanism going into the wire. So you can put it in those two places. A simple loading coil itself could be put somewhere along the wire. You're probably not going to choose that one. So the tuning mechanism, there's at least two places where you can put it. So there's quite a bit of experimenting to be done here. However, when you do succeed in making the radiator electronically a half-wave long, with the right kind of doodads, L network, screwdriver, antenna tuner, whatever, the right kind of doodads, when you do succeed in making a half-wave end-fed radiator with this very simple grounding system that's going to exist on your property, when you finally solve that problem. Let me drop this. You have an obligation. You may not fulfill it. You have an obligation to publish an article on this. The amateur community is very unfamiliar with half-wave resonating radiating structures. When I tried going with multiple emails to the doctors in on this particular subject, we made some progress, but I wasn't able to sell the idea. There's a huge improvement in ease of feeding power into your antenna if you're willing to go to a half-wave resonator instead of a quarter-wave resonator. All ground planes usually are quarter-wave resonators. The only half-wave resonators we use is a center-fed half-wave dipole. Well, that's if you insist on feeding it in the middle. There's nothing magic about feeding it in the middle. If you're willing to feed it at one end, there's a huge improvement in half-wave electronic length instead of quarter-wave. So when you do solve this problem and get the gangbuster signals again, assuming the ionosphere will support you, you've got to write an article on this one and sell the concept. Right now, it's difficult to sell. W2BZ, K2LIW.
And Zooey out.
I would be happy. If I can get 100 watts into this antenna on 40 with very little back, and it not be mounted on the car, be mounted on a tripod, a photographic tripod, on my walkway, 5 feet or 10 feet from my door, I would be most willing to write up how I made that happen.
Fantastic. Okay. Good luck with that project. It's not going to be falling off a log. It's going to take a fair amount of experimenting. You're going to be coming back in future weeks saying, I did this, I got that result, and what do you recommend I do next? There's going to be a few of those. We're expecting that. N2EO, K2LIW. Go ahead, Rich, number one.
Okay, Jake, N2EO. As far as the half-wave vertical, I have one in Whitestone. Who's a Custrass? R8 is a half-wave multiband vertical, uses traps and stubs, I guess you call them stubs, with a matching unit to match it back to 50 ohms. It only requires 7 4-foot radios, which come with the antenna. I got super-duper results.
Yeah, that's good information, Rich. It's one of those rare antennas that is half-wave, claims it's half-wave, tells the amateurs that it's half-wave, uses that concept, and therefore drastically decreases the amount of heroic requirements for the counterpoise. Okay, we've gone a little bit longer than I should have. I'm cutting into AC2GS. I'm cutting into Roy's time. AC2 Golf of Sierra. We've got some beautiful material to give us. And by the way, Roy wants you to participate, so please try to make some comments to his puzzles if he gives us one and whatever. He's going to be telling us quite a few unusual things tonight. AC2GS with Science Talk, K2RIW. You got it, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. And I was at the Hamfest today. It was loads of fun. I sat on a table next to Andy. I didn't take away Andy's shade. We were covered by a canopy. The difference was that I picked the chair inside the canopy square, and he decided to put his chair on the other side, outside of the canopy portion. So that's that story. And if Lou NY2H is listening, John Casey 2SHO is having some problems with the IRLP link, so he might want to take a look at that. As far as N2EO's comment about the dubious software, you have to be very cautious, because every lame piece of software has websites usually published by the same company reviewing their product and saying that it's great stuff. And you can, unfortunately, go by the call centers having Pakistani accents, because if you legitimately call up Microsoft You very often will get the same Pakistani accent. It's just less expensive to hire technical call center staff in India and Pakistan.
Stand by a second here, Roy. I'm pretty sure we did hear from Lou. NY2H, go ahead with what you were about to say, Lou.
Yeah, I'll take a look at that. It's RLP. Okay.
Okay. I'm hearing beautiful signals out of Eastern Machine and Western Machine, but of course that's not IRLP. So, AC2GS, you got it again, Roy. Please proceed.
Okay, very good, Dick. Well, like I said, I thought it was loads of fun at the Ham Fest. It was a little bit quiet at the beginning, I guess because most people went into the central area where there was the buying and the selling and such. I was near the entrance, so oftentimes people came in and rushed to the center and did what they did, and as they were leaving, they would see, I put up a little sign, you know, the wonderful world of 3D. I 3D printed lettering and put magnets on it, and I even had a kind of mini science talk with people were asking me, it was sticking to stainless steel, and they said stainless steel shouldn't be magnetic, and I tried to explain that there are different types of stainless steel, some of which are not magnetic, but others which are magnetic. And the curious, weird thing about magnetism, and there's so many, is that the stainless steel that's not magnetic usually is the one that's filled with a good percentage of nickel, which by itself is magnetic as well. So stainless steel with chrome and with nickel isn't the magnetic. So those figure that magnetism is a curious, curious thing. Let me drop.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Just a quick piece of information about the stainless steel. When you weld stainless steel, especially something thick, they put stringers on when you wear. I'm talking about pipe. It could be straight. It doesn't matter. But they put stringers on it. You go around once, and then you go around again, and another one. You put sometimes layer after layer on, depending on how thick the material is. But if you put what's called a weave on, and you're using a stainless steel rod, and you're going left and right, you can do that on a regular carbon steel. You can go left to right, and then you can build it up instead of going around completely around merry-go around every time. You can just build up just by going left, right. And now, if it's stainless steel, the reason they don't want you to do that, you're losing the stainless steel effect. You can put a magnet near that, and it'll stick. You'll notice it has that magnetic effect. So you could change the properties of that just by the way, it depends on what you're doing and how you're working with it. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, Paul. I mean, among other things, what's going on is it's actually the lattice structure of the grain pattern. There's two basic different types of stainless steel. There's something called austenitic stainless steel, and that's the non-magnetic type. It usually is doped with a little bit of chromium and nickel. And then there's something called ferritic stainless steel, which has less of those materials in them. And those are ferromagnetic. So, it's curious how if you add a magnetic material to another magnetic material, it's not magnetic anymore. I just find magnetism incredibly complicated and intriguing.
Oh, yeah, so do I. It's amazing stuff. In fact, I just bought a couple of magnets from Harbor Freight. Super powerful for like, a dollar. I couldn't believe it. So, it's just amazing. I'll let you continue on, Roy. I just wanted to jump in about the stainless steel comment.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Paul. Feel free to drop in, break in at any time if you have any points of interest. I don't know the strength of the magnets. I assume they're not incredibly strong. When these neodymium magnets get to be particularly strong and, they get 20, 30, 40, 50 pounds of attraction force, you got to be very careful. You can nip a piece of your skin between them, and they can bruise the heck out of you. And some of the larger ones that I don't think anyone, unless they know exactly what they're doing, should handle, can actually fracture bones if their hand is between two large neodymium magnets.
Okay. He's a proper freight. I mean, I don't think they're near dealing, but they are strong. And they're batting on a rack, you know, and they line them up, and you go to take them apart, just so you can bring it to the counter to pay for it. You got to pull at these things, you know. It's incredible. And they have some really stronger magnets there for bigger money. And then you know what they had that was nice? You could make your own mobile whip out of these things. Some of them have the padded bottom, with chrome on top, where, it looks like the base of a mag mount, a little screw type of thing where you could screw something into the top of it. I could picture somebody making little mobile mounts out of this thing. And they're cheap, like $4 for this, for this chrome-plated round magnet thing. About two and a, they make one about 2.5 and another one about 3 inches in diameter. And really powerful, too. I'm totally amazed. Like $4 or $5. Incredible.
Yeah, the Chinese have pretty much taken over the manufacturing. They have neodymium locally, and they mine it in foreign mines, and it's amazing the low price for these things. They're basically sintered powdered metal that's bound together, and it's very brittle, so they coat it with a chrome or a nickel finish to kind of protect the... That's why... probably more than any other magnet, it's the easiest magnet to chip. They're very brittle.
The program 60 Minutes tonight, the very first of the three sections, was on the rare earth materials that are now becoming scarce. And do we have good relationship with China, so we continue to buy it from them? And neodymium is one of the main things they were worried about. So you get a slightly scary sounding piece of information if you review 60 Minutes tonight, the first of the three sections. ODU Roy, KQLIW.
Okay, I will do that. I mean, I realize there's a lot of rare earth metals that are incredibly important in the production of our 21st century electronic gadgets. Indium is necessary for tin indium electrodes that are used as the capacitive sensors in all of our touchpads, and tantalum, of course, is very important for certain capacitors, and they're all rare earths, and they have a mine in China, but the Chinese companies are buying up properties and land in other countries and doing the mining as well. So we're going to have to be nice to them if we want to keep building our little gadgets.
Right now, our president is not always making the relationship between us and China and the tariffs and whatever. We need China. China needs us. So we better stay friendly, as I see it. Back to you, Roy.
Hope so. I mean, China has a... We have a legitimate problem with China that they don't really respect intellectual property. They clone and copy everything, and they're not upset by that because it has no particular value for them to respect that. So intellectual property is going to be a big problem in the years to come, and I hope there's some agreement where we can all play together and not mess up the world, but we'll see. In addition to the three-dimensional modeling that I demonstrated, I also brought a little toy along. I showed a bunch of people that demonstrates Lenz's law. It's basically just a copper tube and a neodymium round magnet, and you drop the round magnet through the opening of the copper core, and it slows down. It does magnetic braking, so I showed that to a bunch of people. Wait. Getting back to Science Talk, as always, if you have any topics, if you have any questions, if you have any answers, if you have anything that you want or need to tell me, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. I will have links to all the articles that I mentioned and YouTube's on subjects and such, so take a look and click it and have some fun. You can do that at roy.ac2gs.com. roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, there's the chat room, which you can get to either by the front page of Limark's website, or you can just type chat.ac2gs.com, and it'll bring you to the chat room. Those are things to remember. Let me drop for a second, and we'll begin with a puzzler. Okay, someone earlier this week requested a botanical topic night. There's a lot of frightening stuff written about genetically modified organisms, or they call them GMOs, all kind of ways that science is fooling around with Mother Nature. So I thought it might be interesting to ask as a puzzle about food that we eat. There are foods that that are pretty much been cloned for a while now. They're identical generation after generation, the plant equivalent of the Clone Wars. So my question for tonight, if anyone wants to entertain it, is anyone want to hazard a guess of one of the oldest kinds of cloned type of foods that pretty much everyone out there has eaten and most likely enjoyed?
C2.
Yes, John, and welcome back to IRLP. Yes, what's your guess?
Wild guess, bananas. That's my guess. KC2SHO.
That's a very good one. Let me ask if anyone else has any entries for this.
N12VDH.
Yes, John.
I'm going to guess corn.
Okay, anyone else with any guesses out there?
Doesn't corn require pollinizing for each individual nugget that's on that little chip that's on that ear? And doesn't the process require male and female pollen? I might be wrong on that one. Oh, you're right. You can tell I don't really know.
Well, Dick, yes, it does. Corn is sexually reproduced, and the kernels themselves are future seeds for future generations of corn. But, you know, guesses are good. I always like guesses, and it kind of expands the topic a little bit.
N1YDY with a guess.
Yes, Hank.
I was going to guess wheat, but it's probably sexually reproduced like corn, but that's my guess.
WA2MHL. Guess? My guess would be potato.
Hey, now, potato is a very interesting choice. Okay. Anyone else with any other guesses or facts on the subject? Didn't quite get that call sign.
Yeah, it's WB2I. My choice is the soy, soybean, the first one they get. There is a model now. And then this one is the corn.
The premise for tonight is not genetically modified organisms. There are many, and they're diverse. What I was trying to get at is the idea that we sort of think that this is a modern thing that just started a couple of years ago and are frightened by it all. The concept is that there have been plant products that have been for decades upon decades effectively cloned. They're genetic identical copies of each other, and so that people shouldn't be quite that frightened of genetically modified organisms. So we're not really talking about what organisms are genetically modified in modern ways, but more of what type of food that we take for granted that are basically clones of every other type of that food that we've been eating.
J2NBB with a guess.
Yes, Bob.
Roy, how about bean curd, tofu, and similar products?
That's my guess.
Oh, Okay, again, beans are kind of sexually reproduced. See, the trick, I think, is you have to think of something that in one way or the other is kind of seedless.
Okay, with that clue, N1YDY, I guess grapes.
Okay, as long as you kind of qualify it by saying seedless grapes, because there are seeded grapes out there. So you are correct in that seedless grapes, because of the nature of seedless grapes, don't give you seeds, have to be reproduced some other way, and that's what's going on with them. I don't think seedless grapes are as old as some of the other things that we've taken for granted, and that other people have guessed correctly. And we'll talk about some of those things as well. Okay, what I was sort of thinking of is the common banana. Now, botanically, it's classified not necessarily as a fruit, but as a berry. It grows on banana plants, although some people like to call them banana trees. They're really not trees. They have something called a pseudostem rather than a true trunk. There are different varieties of bananas. There are different types of varieties of apples, the same way. The most common kind of banana that we are most familiar with is called the Cavendish banana. It's a variety that came into existence way back in 1836, but it became the most popular variety after an even older variety called Gros Michel died off due to a fungal disease called the Panama disease. Seedless fruits are much easier to deal with, but without seeds, growing them, you have a problem. You got to cultivate them, and the way that farmers and such have done it is by cutting. You cut the stems and you plant them, or you stick them into other plants that have root systems, and you grow effectively clones. Every Cavendish banana that you've ever eaten since the 1950s has been genetically identical to all the others. You know, no seeds, no sex. Let me drop for a sec. So that's one of the oldest ones. I mean, I kind of waffled on the description because there are other things that are approximately around the same age, give or take, and one of them is the potato. Potatoes, I'm sure everyone has done that in school, where you take a whole potato and you stick it in a bottle with some toothpicks and you watch the tubers grow out and you grow potatoes. Or other people, you cut little wedges where the eyes are and you plant them in the soil and they grow new potatoes. So for the subject of potatoes, I have another question. And Dick mentioned it. Do potatoes have seeds?
I've seen potatoes growing in my grandfather's farm. The plant itself, with the portion that's above ground, I think I remember seeing a blossom on it. And if I did see a blossom, does that mean it's got a flower and the usual hardware where pollen could be involved? Maybe I've got a lousy memory on what I saw with those 100 acres of potatoes growing in his field in Kings Park. Over to you, Roy. KQIW.
Dick, you have an excellent memory when it comes to the flowers on a potato plant. Potatoes do flower. They do produce seeds. They do produce a fruit, if you will. Fruit is basically defined as the ovaries of a mature flower. The problem, though, among other things, is that potatoes above ground have a lot of stuff that's poisonous. It makes you sick if you ate the top part of the potato. If you ate the fruit of the potato, it would make you really ill. But it does have seeds. It does have a fruit. I wouldn't suggest it to anyone or anything, but it does have it. Potatoes aren't really grown by seeds because it puts too much variation in the type of potato. By using cuttings of the eyes, they keep the same identical genetics with the same characteristics that they prefer. And so that's another version of cloned varieties. The botanists can still mix and match using seeds to come up with new strains and then use cuttings for it. But yeah, potatoes have seeds. I wouldn't suggest anyone eat them.
Give us a couple of words on the word fruit that the potato produces. I presume it's something above ground, which I think you're saying you can't eat. The actual potato that we do eat, the tuber, I think it's called, below ground, if that's not the intended product of that plant, is that just a root that became fat and it's a method of storing carbohydrate? Does the potato plant produce two final products simultaneously, a fruit above ground and a tuber below ground? Bring me up to speed. What's really going on with this potato plant? Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Yes, indeed. But potatoes are confusing in that they both reproduce sexually and asexually. Sexual reproduction is from the flowers above ground. They're pollinated by other potato flowers, and they ripen into small poisonous fruits, which I wouldn't suggest anyone try. But in addition, potatoes have tubers. They have bulbs of high carbohydrate content where they store a great deal of energy and which they use as sites to send out little rhizomes of potato plants and to reproduce asexually under the soil. So they have two roots. The seeds get scattered in the air and the tubers are more local manifestations.
I presume the seeds come out inside of the fruit. The usual definition of fruit, if I understand correctly, is that it's something that some animal will pick up, eat, distribute the seeds, and therefore they get scattered far and wide. So the fruit itself, some animal must think it's not poisonous in order to use it to scatter the seeds that I think are inside of that fruit. Correct me on this one, Roy. K2IW.
Well, not necessarily. A fruit, as far as botanists are concerned, is a much more general term for any ripened ovary, which is part of the flowering mechanism. Some fruits are designed to attract animals to eat them, and the seeds are protected from digestion, and so they defecate the seeds all over the place, and that's a method that they spread them. Other plants don't really rely on other animals to eat the fruit. They tend to have brittle fruit, if you will, and hope for mostly airborne traveling of the seeds. I am not aware of any particular animal that successfully eats the potato fruits, so I tend to think that it's the potatoes depend more on that method of spreading their seeds than animals.
Thank you for that, Roy. I really like watermelon. I believe there are some varieties of watermelon that are essentially seedless. Is that watermelon reproduced in a somewhat cloned manner? Over to you, Roy.
As pretty much every seedless type of fruit that you can imagine effectively needs to be reproduced some other way because it has no seeds, obviously. So again, most of the time, the old method was the simple approach of taking cuttings. And there are very nice turn of the previous century's devices that almost automated them. They cut little V-slits into the stem so that they could be cut male and female and placed into other plants' root system. So yeah, anything that's seedless, the seedless grapes, the seedless watermelons, have to reproduce by cutting. It's a little bit more labor intensive probably, but I think most people will pay a premium for seedless fruits.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
On board the space station, they have a veggie program. So they've been working with,
very simple vegetables for now, you know, rhubarb or something, some kind of lettuce. But now they got there's an advanced one, let's call it Veggie 2, you know, they're going to make it more complex and, better fruit, better tasting fruit, bigger fruit. So what would be the fruits that they would use? Would you go with clone or non-clone? What would be better for a space station, you know, a long-duration space, and eventually, you know, taking the fruits to the moon or to Mars, you know, where you can't come back and get any fertilizer or anything. So what would be the best ones? Should you use cloned or non-cloned, or do you think it doesn't matter?
Well, as I see it, the benefit of cloning is that you definitely know what you're getting. There's no variety, there's no variation. You know all the qualities that kind of is built into that gene pattern. Whereas if you go with seeds, there's a degree of variability. I mean, you can limit that by making sure that it cross-fertilizes identical plant stock. But the whole point to kind of focus on sexual reproduction for plants is to increase the variability and find new varieties that have new and useful features. So probably what they would end up doing for the most part is looking at all the present genetic types available and cloning the ones that they think are the most suitable for a spacecraft.
And to Rio.
Listen, when that new information eventually comes out, it should come out this year. You know, right now they have a square meter, which, you know, that's the first thing they've had that for quite a few years now, and now they're going to add another square meter, so they're doubling the size. And they did say they were going to use more advanced stuff, but now I don't know what they're using. I'll find out when it comes out. Very good work.
N2EO.
Very good, Paul. Yes, N2EO, you had something to say.
That's good evening, boy. N2EO. Listen, I don't know if playing with Mother Nature is a good idea or not. I've been told of a fly, what they call love bugs, in Florida. I don't know if you heard of them. Maybe it's fictitious, but they were made in the laboratory. That's a story I got about love bugs. And they were a terrible plague on society in Florida. Do you think it's a good idea, in your opinion, to be playing around with nature? Also, if you want to look at it this way, the Bible says we were created in God's image. Does that mean we were caught? And also, a very provocative thing. Are we going to be cloning people in the future? That really has a lot of question marks.
Okay, Richie, as far as playing God, for whatever, you know, you want to say, man has been doing that since we stopped being hunter-gatherers and became interested in agriculture. We have perfected the grains that have the traits that we prize more than others. Mankind has driven the engine that basically led us to domesticated cows and goats and chickens and what have you. They would be completely different creatures if we weren't around. So we've been breeding stock since agriculture began thousands of years ago. So it's a little too late to not play God as far as agriculture and farm animals are concerned. I'm not quite sure. I think that the urban legend, the love bug thing. Genetic engineering is a very powerful tool and or weapon, and I've said this before, but I might as well say it again. A hammer is a great thing. You can build a house with a hammer. Unfortunately, you could also crush a guy's skull with a hammer. It's just a tool. You could use it for good. You could use it for evil. You could use it for something in between. So I think genetic engineering can be dangerous in the wrong hands with the wrong motivation. But I think it's inevitable. You're not going to really stop it. You're not going to make it illegal. So you might as well set guidelines and such and try and control it that way. Will people be cloned? I think people will be cloned. I don't know when, but I think it will be. They're already cloning dogs and cats. If your loved dog is dying, if you send them genetic material, I think in China, it's always China, they will grow you another dog. There are people out there who have these dogs. It's not really the same animal. It's just like it's twins. It looks sort of the same, but otherwise it's a different animal. But clones are in the future. There's pretty much nothing we can do about it.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, I can't tell, boy. I really don't know. Nobody knows what the future holds. If we do clone people, all for you for good, not bad. Pick up the other station, boy, and to we else.
Okay, Richie. Well, as always, I hope people use tools effectively for good and not for evil. So what do you have to say, John?
I think one of the things that has caused some of the rebellion against GMO is the underlying reason behind it. For example, I know that one of the things Monsanto has done is to introduce GMO corn that would become tolerant to an insecticide made by Monsanto, of course. Now, exactly what that does as far as the digestibility of the corn, it might be an open question. I personally think, and I don't really have too much proof for it, but I think a lot of the obesity may be done to the caused by the fact that the body may not know what to do with some of these GMO organisms. So it is something that should require more research. Go ahead.
Well, I'm always for more research. You know, there's more information is much better than less information. GMOs is a touchy political subject. It tends to be more problematic for economic reasons. Companies are trying to copyright seeds so that if they're allowed to, you can grow their seeds. If their seeds fly into your farm area and you let them grow, they can sue you. And there's a lot of weird law that hasn't really been cleaned up about that. And you're right, they have been tweaking and designing and putting insecticide into the genetic code. And we don't know what that's going to do. Again, some people are less cautious than other people. I don't think that that's the cause of obesity because GMOs haven't quite been around that long, but American obesity has been a consistent, although a worsening problem. One of the problems is that just non-GMO corn, corn fructose, is now the fundamental sweetener used. The body doesn't really work as well with that as with other forms of sugar. Not that it's good to just eat sugar, because if you ever look at a container of sugar, you can keep it in the bag for 10,000 years. It never goes bad. So it's not the most healthiest thing in the world, just, sugar. But cane sugar is probably a little bit healthier than the sucrose of corn syrup. So I think that's what might be going on. I think that's unrelated to the GMO, though.
So we know again.
One final comment. Just one comment on that. I personally have noticed since I stopped eating a corn-based product that I knew was GMO and switched to a breakfast cereal that was part of the non-GMO project. They had the little sticker on the box there. I have noticed a change in the response of my blood sugar levels after eating. I used to get quite a bit of overshoot, and now after giving up that regular breakfast cereal, corn, GMO'd in it, I've noticed the change, but that might just be me. Anyway, you can pick up the other person.
Hey John, we'll get to Rich in a second. What I would like to ask, if you know, is if the difference is